Hallo und herzlich willkommen an Tag 2 unseres Kongressjournals. Mein Name ist Eva Winreuter. Bevor wir uns den großen Fragestellungen in Europa widmen, fangen wir diese Folge aber etwas profaner an. Denn vielleicht haben Sie sich auch schon einmal gefragt, wo die Alpbacher eigentlich hingehen, wenn es heiß ist. Auf dem Berg könnte man meinen, aber ganz so einfach ist das nicht.
Gehst du mal am Berg um, heißt aber herunten. Ich bin nur gerade grenzen, dass wir 5000 Meter sind.
Das war die pensionierte Alpbacherin Martina Lederer, die im Übrigen im gleichen Haus geboren wurde, in dem sie heute noch lebt. Und die uns bereits gestern etwas über die zunehmende Sommerhitze im Ort erzählt hat. Aber nun zurück zur eigentlichen Frage. Wenn man sich nicht einmal auf 1800 Metern Seehöhe abkühlen kann, ja, wo denn dann?
Ja, nachdem wir kein Hallenbad mehr haben, weil das die Gemeinde nicht mehr leisten kann. Jetzt geht man halt da eine nach Innalbach, den linken Graben, das ist der Lugergraben. Da ist wunderschön da drin, da ist kühl am Bach. Ne? Da, nach Innalbach sind es 3 Kilometer und nachher geht man noch einmal 2 Kilometer oder 3, dass man so richtig zum das Gemütlich, 2 Kilometer kann man sagen. Ne?
Wobei, noch näher ist der namensgebende Bach im Ort.
Unser Wasser wäre der Alpbach da unten, also südlich vom Lagerhaus rein da. Wir als Kinder, wir haben ja kein Schwimmbad gehabt. Das war unser Bubi-Schwimmbad, weil das Haus hat Bubi geheißen. Ne? Und da haben wir, geschwommen. Aber für Noble nicht zu empfehlen. Was auch, einen Reiterer See haben wir. Ne? In Reit, das ist gut. Da sind wir nachher auch gegangen, wenn wir schon größer waren. Da haben wir auch schwimmen gelernt. Und der ist heute noch schön, schön warm. Und das ist ein Moorsee. Das ist 10 Kilometer von da aus, ne? Talauswärts.
Ja, und zum Reiterer See gehen sogar direkt Shuttlebusse. Am besten fahren Sie zur Haltestelle Reitergemeindeamt. So, und nun zurück zum Forum und den Themen, die uns hier beschäftigen.
So join us in this fantastic endeavor.
Presse Play. Was in Alpbach wichtig ist.
It's gonna be a war.
Der Pressepodcast aus Alpbach wird unterstützt von der Erste Group.
Wir haben Ihnen ja Visionäre und deren neue Ideen für Europa versprochen. Ein solcher Visionär ist Alberto Alemanno. Er ist Italiener und Jurist und Professor für EU-Recht an der HEC-Universität in Paris. Außerdem ist er einer der führenden Stimmen in Europa, wenn es darum geht, die Demokratie zu den Menschen zu bringen. Er hat mehrere Bücher geschrieben, wie man Bürgerinnen und Bürger dazu motivieren kann, sich in eine Gesellschaft zu engagieren. Aber auch, wie sie ihre Forderungen gegenüber dem Staat durchsetzen können. Und für alle Forumsbesucher aus dem Ausland, die es genießen, hier keine Roaming-Gebühren zu zahlen, das ist unter anderem Alemanno und seinen Pariser Studenten zu verdanken, die sich mit ihrer European Citizen Initiative dafür eingesetzt haben. Doch darum soll es in dieser Folge nur am Rande gehen. Denn wofür Alemanno seit Jahren brennt und worüber Sie schnell mit ihm diskutieren können, wenn Sie ihn treffen, ist die Frage, warum es in Europa so schwierig ist, sich auf eine gemeinsame europäische Politik zu einigen. Oder anders formuliert, why is it so difficult to make European politics in Europe?
My provocative answer to you is that because we don't do politics in Europe. Europeans do a lot of things together. They travel, they invest, they buy, they look for jobs, they get married, but they never do politics together. And what do I mean by that? I mean that even for the European elections, we vote on different dates in Europe. We vote for national parties that present us national programs. There's nothing European to that. What does it mean? It means that our political representatives and dynamics in Brussels are national. They are not European. But if they were European, meaning we could, Austrians, Maltese, Finns and Portuguese have the same conversation about the same issue, which is how do we respond to the Ukrainian invasion, to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we would be probably more likely to provide an answer. If we were discussing about which should be the minimum wage in Europe, we would bring a perspective that today is simply not there. But if we only were able to have this conversation as we had during COVID times, if you think about it, COVID was the first time in which all Europeans had a shared experience.
But we had totally different ways of dealing with it.
I think COVID, in a way, showed the limits of the nation state because there was a transboundary issue. The virus was circulating. So no country alone would have been able to solve the issue. And also the potential for Europe to be no longer just a troublemaker, but to be a problem solver by allowing coordination among us. And most importantly, by relaunching our economy, by injecting a lot of funding that would have not arrived or landed in our countries. Of course, what I'm saying is not very popular. Political leaders won't tell you that the next generation EU has been such a big success story. But certainly these, we should be proud of it, because again, without this emergency situation, we would have not Europeanized this situation. And I think given the nature of the challenges facing the continent, ranging from climate to the use of artificial intelligence or solar radiation modification, you know, to tackle possible heat waves, we really have to come together as peoples of Europe with a common voice.
Okay, but have you seen any government at the moment in Europe that says, okay, it's more important the European idea than the national idea?
Why national politicians who are elected locally should tell you that Europe matters more than their constituency? But that's the truth. We live in a fiction. Already now the big decisions are taken in Brussels, not in Vienna. Can we say this? Why politicians should say so? They have no incentives to tell you the truth. So they are just bashing the European Union for everything they do bad, and they take the credit for the good things we're doing in Brussels. But Brussels is them. They should be proud about their European decision. Unless we're going to start electing our politicians at the pan-European level, allowing an Austrian to be voted by Germans, to be voted by Danish or by Italians, we're not going to be able to have European representation. We are just going to be hiding ourselves behind a fiction that decisions are still taken in Rome, in Vienna, and in Copenhagen.
Absolutely. But how do you get people there? Because at the moment, if you tell any Austrian they should do the election in Germany, or any German do an election in Austria, I mean, people will faint immediately.
True, Eva, but a German election has huge repercussions for Austria. The outcome of those elections will have huge spillover effect on individual countries whose people cannot vote there, right? So this is the problem. We accept the decisions taken by other citizens that affect us without claiming any right to have a say. And that's what Europe is about. It's about giving us that right.
But how do you get people there? Because like everybody who is a bit involved in policymaking knows this perfectly well and has no problem with it. But the majority of the Europeans, I say...
The best solution ever is to provide in the European elections a ballot box in which every national political party will have to say which is their European political family. So you will have full clarity in knowing what these people are going to be doing in Europe for you. This is not the case. We have parties active, running for European elections, who we don't know who to belong to at the European level. This is totally schizophrenic. I'll give you a couple of examples. Ciudadanos is a Spanish party, which is disappearing now. It's the Liberals. It's the equivalent of NEOS in Austria, that has been adopting a pro-European stance in Brussels at the European level. They were the closest friends of Macron. But in Spain, they were flirting Vox, which is the far-right party. How is it possible? They had a double game because people were not able to see that Ciudadanos was one thing at the national level and another thing at the European level. But if they were forced to say who they were at the European level, this would have not been possible. It would have been intelligible. I give you another example. Five Star Movement is the second most voted party in Italy at the moment. They've been around for 10 years. We still don't know what is their European stance, because their MEPs, their members of European Parliament, they don't belong to any European political party. They are independent. Sometimes they vote pro-Europe, sometimes they vote against Europe. Most of the times they don't know. So this lack of intelligibility, how the system works, is what is preventing citizens to actually get a sense of what is going on or what is happening.
So the first step would be like every national election, even if it's on, let's say, kind of a local area, should always kind of like be connected, what's the point of view, to the European Union?
Correct. I think every single policy, even those with a local relevance, have also European repercussions, because if Linz has a good idea on how to run public transports, well, that idea should be circulated and might become the next big European idea. In other words, we need to Europeanize local solutions and we need to nationalize or localize European solutions, because this back and forth is going to create growth. We need to be more creative in the way in which we create political innovation than just following the old way of thinking, you know, this is the national, this is the European, and this is Silov. It's no longer Silov.
But how do you overcome all those prejudices? I mean, like, there's always, not every country loves all the other countries in Europe. There's so much cultural gap. How do you unify this?
I give you some data on this point, Eva, which make me think a lot. So if I ask you, how many European citizens live in a different country than the country in which they were born? The answer is 4%, which is 20 million. It's not bad, but it's more. But if I ask you, how many European citizens, including Austrians, do travel at least once outside of Austria, outside of their country, or they have family there? They have their kids, their parents, their friends. Well, that number skyrockets to 50%. That means one European out of two is exposed to the European Union. And those people don't have biases or prejudices because they're benefiting from
Europe. I don't believe that, because they go on holiday, they're in a holiday bubble, and it's really different if you're in a bubble abroad or if you really accept to live there, because then you have to adapt and get an idea.
They might be close to a bubble, but they enjoy their freedom to travel to another country and to see their opportunities being multiplied by 27, because the average Austrian can buy a house, can find a partner, can find a job in 26 other countries. This is a multiplier of opportunities. So if you present it that way and these people experience it, I think their prejudices might be going against, or they're not going to be actively against the European problem. Where we have an issue is that the other 50% is not mobile, is very immobile. And those people tend to be those who are a bit more reticent to believe that there is life beyond the national borders, right? And those are the people that historically have been set aside by the European project, which has always put a reward or a premium on those who are mobile as opposed to those who are immobile. And that's where we probably need to catch up and do things and show that even if you don't move around, you are still benefiting from Europe, because you might be receiving services or opportunities which are potential. You are not going to be doing it, but your kids might have this opportunity.
But shouldn't be also kind of like education and communications about European Union be more intensified, because like there's enough Austrians who don't have any idea how the political system in our own country works.
Right. I think the good thing about changing the rules of the game is that once the rules of the game are there, those they create incentive for everybody. I didn't mention the media, but the media, they have a huge role in playing such a pedagogical function. Historically, media were presenting the terms of reference, right? What the debate is about, and then telling you what they think about this. So if we change the rules of the game, we have a new electoral system, the media will be nudged to cover all local issues from a European perspective. And that's exactly the kind of vision I have for Europe since a long time, Europeanizing it, to then decide that certain things should be decided at the local level and therefore to be nationalized.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eva, for the opportunity.
Während Alberto Alemano auch mit den Studierenden über eine gemeinsame Europapolitik diskutiert, haben die Stipendiaten auch wichtige Diskussionen abseits der Seminare, wie sie mir auf der Terrasse des Kongresscenters erzählten. Nämlich, werden Soft Skills, also zum Beispiel Empathie, nicht einfach viel zu sehr vernachlässigt, wenn es darum geht, ein Europa der Zukunft zu formen?
Magst du dir einfach mal ganz kurz vorstellen, wie du heißt und warum dass du da bist?
Bin die Melanie. Ich bin da wegen Connecten, nicht nur mit irgendwelchen Persönlichkeiten, die man im Schedule, wie man schon am Termin sagt, sondern vor allem auch, ich bin mit der Initiativgruppe Wien da und ich bin jeden Tag beeindruckter, mit welcher Gruppe ich da eigentlich da bin. Es sind extrem coole Leute. Es sind Leute da, die ein CV haben in einem Alter, den man sich kaum vorstellen kann, aber gleichzeitig einfach wirklich nette Leute sind und mit denen man einfach auf einer anderen Ebene connecten kann. Alleine bei unserem Abendessen, bei unserem täglichen Nudeln mit Pesto essen, haben wir tolle Gespräche und gefühlt genauso lehrreich wie die Seminare, die wir jetzt gerade haben.
Was für ein Gespräch ist da in Erinnerung?
Wir haben einen Fireside-Chat gehabt und nach dieser Runde haben wir uns dann noch ein bisschen zusammengesetzt und haben gefragt, das sind eigentlich immer professionelle Gespräche und es geht um Fakten, es geht um Backgrounds, um ein CV, was hat man gemacht. Das ist eine Art von Skill und wir haben irgendwie haben wir dann darüber geredet, dass dieses so Soft Skills irgendwie ein bisschen unterrepräsentiert sind. Da geht es um, wie geht es weiter mit Europa, wo ist die USA, wo ist China, Ukraine, Russlandkrieg. Das sind extrem wichtige Themen, die wir besprechen. Und oftmals wird irgendwie so Soft Skills wie einfach ein gutes Herz haben ein bisschen ausgelassen.
Was sind Soft Skills, die Europa braucht?
Ich glaube, einerseits, vor allem, wir haben die ganzen Stipendiatinnen, die eben viele Soft Skills mitbringen. Und wir haben Alpbach mit sehr vielen Professionals da. Und diese Menschengruppen zusammenzubringen, nämlich einerseits motivierte junge Leute, die vielleicht manchmal ein bisschen naiv wirken, aber trotzdem ein gutes Herz haben. Und ich sage jetzt gar nicht, dass die andere Gruppe das nicht hat. Gar nicht. Das meine ich nicht damit. Ich meine eher, dass man optimistische Ideen, nämlich mutige Ideen mit Leuten, die in einem System arbeiten, zusammenbringt. Und das ist für mich auch, das passt irgendwie auch ganz gut mit dem Thema Bold Europe zusammen, nämlich, dass man junge Leute dabei hat, die mutig sind, die sich was trauen, die was zum Sagen haben, einfach in solchen Rahmen wie im Fireside-Chat zusammenzubringen und dass man dadurch irgendwie was Neues schafft. Und ich glaube, das passiert auch.
Das war Tag 2 aus Alpbach. Wenn Sie Anregungen oder gar ein Thema haben, das wir im Podcast diskutieren und mitnehmen sollten, dann schreiben Sie uns doch unter podcast@diepresse.com. Mein Name ist Eva Winreuter und vielleicht sehen wir uns ja gleich im Kongresscenter. Wenn nicht, dann bis morgen in diesem Kanal.
Presse Play. Was in Alpbach wichtig ist.